Welcome to the Pin Down, a Detroit Pistons podcast. I'm your host, Wes Davenport from Motor City Hoops and Detroit Bad Boys. And I am joined today by a special guest co-host. Our guy Blake is off on a fun vacation. And, you know, guys, in all seriousness, fantastic timing on his end there to miss some of this stuff. But we could not be more excited for who's stepping in today. It's Brady Fredrickson from Detroit Bad Boys. Brady, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty good, man. I mean, when it's, you know, days before Christmas, you can't complain about that. It kind of makes the sting of wasting 3 hours every other night watching the Detroit Pistons a little bit easier, right?
I don't know if it makes it any easier, Brady. I'm still struggling through it. You know, before we get into that, because it's going to get unavoidable, we're going to break down that Jazz game. We're going to dive into all of the background noise that was going on during and then after it as well. So I want to ask you this, kind of on a more positive note. What's your favorite holiday movie, and why is it one of those awesome claymation specials?
It's not that, although I can't wait my daughter is like 1.5, and I can't wait for her to watch the really bad claymation Rudolph movie. But my favorite, I would say, has to probably be Vacation, Christmas Vacation. I just default to that one. And like, I know, you know, you get to that point with Christmas where you know, you watch them every year, so you know how it's going to go. That one I just always get a kick out of still, and like, it's like very classic Chevy Chase in all the good ways and none of the bad ways. But that's probably my number one. I would say number two, I also, my wife really likes Four Christmases. I think that one's very funny too. That's
Scott. Vince Vaughn one?
Vince Vaughn and Reese Witherspoon. Yeah, that one's pretty funny too. Especially the scene when they're playing cards with his brother and his wife. It's hilarious. Like, that one's pretty good. Those are two that I really kind of gravitate towards.
You're just completely erasing Santa Claus is Coming to Town, though. You're just ignoring it. That's a classic. All those are classics.
Honestly, any of the black and white Christmas movies, I have no interest in watching. Like I have a friend who every Christmas Eve, he and his wife have to watch It's a Wonderful Life. And I'm like, I've never even made it through It's a Wonderful Life. Like, that's, it's a snoozer to me. Like, I understand it's like classic Christmas, but it's just not my vibe.
All right, I got a kind of obscure one here for you guys if you want to go look it up. But it's a movie my family watches every year around Christmas time, and that's Holiday Inn. So it's a Bing Crosby one. Yes, black and white. But it's not White Christmas. It's very, very different. But it's a fun little movie. Very holiday spirit-y. It's a good time. Have you heard of that one?
I have not. I'm Googling it right now because maybe I'll watch it today. And this looks like one that my grandma would have loved to watch.
So that's the movie where, I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas, that whole song. That actually came from that movie, not White Christmas, which is my only little fun fact that I'll give you on Christmas movies today.
That's pretty good.
I know.
You know, another good one that I just started watching again recently was Jingle All the Way with like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sinbad. Like, great 90s nostalgia with that movie. Like, it hits all the right notes, and those two are pretty funny. And it's like, you know, any other holiday movie, like, there are parts where you're like, this feels dated. But when it's like 90s, the dated parts don't always feel so bad to me, because I guess I grew up as like a child of the 90s, so it was okay. But that one I've kind of come back around on recently.
So that's one, yeah, I've come back around on it too, because when I was really young, I loved it. My parents hated it. So I'd have to watch it in like the backseat of the car when we're driving somewhere, instead of like on a big screen, like actually in the living room. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to watch it. And then I, you know, in high school, I was like, nah, never mind. It's cheesy. But now, you know, now I do like it. It's Turbo Time all the time. Fantastic movie.
Yeah, exactly.
No QT, by the way. Die Hard is not a Christmas movie. We don't even need to dive into that. I'm just saying, no, not a Christmas movie.
My thought on that is, I have a theory, is that, so Home Alone, most would consider a Christmas movie. And that's like up there for me too. Probably like my number two, I would say, overall. I had that Four Christmases movie. But if Home Alone, which is not about Christmas, it's about a kid being left alone. Die Hard, which is not about Christmas, it's about a guy trying to like infiltrate the thing, but it happens to happen during, both of them happen during Christmas, but they're not specifically about Christmas. So like, I can see it. I don't like it. I don't like that I've come around on Die Hard as a Christmas movie, but I can see it. Like, you're not wrong.
Here's the thing. It's I don't think Home Alone's really a Christmas movie either. And in fact, I've never sat through all of Home Alone either. So I'm just not the person to talk to about this. I know that's like a classic. Not for me. Not for me. I've never made it through one seating watching Home Alone.
That's unacceptable in my mind. So I'm just gonna leave it there. That's something you need to change in the next 3 days.
I can promise you I won't. But speaking of things that need to change, let's talk about the Pistons game against the Jazz. Brady, there are so
Yeah.
many things that so many directions we could go with this one. I was
Yes.
kind of bad all around, maybe one or two silver linings if you really want to press and search for one. But
No.
where do you want to go first on this game?
No, it's funny. I think us as a fan base have become kind of like, and not like numb to it, but like we've kind of embraced this like toxic mindset because it's really, what else are you gonna do? Like this is the worst situation, like arguably outside of the Lions in a way that any Detroit team has ever faced. Like it's not like it's just a bad stretch. Like it is historic. And so like I see people who are like in this Pistons bubble that are watching it every night and like have formulated these sometimes harsh opinions on things. And then I see people who like are watching from like the exterior, like just on like Twitter and stuff. And like someone last night was like, yeah, I've seen progress. I was like, no, you haven't, dude. There's not, no. Like if you if by saying like I've seen progress with the Pistons is to say, hey, James Wiseman has gone from being horrible to just simply below average, then certainly there's been progress. But collectively, this team is just such a mess that I don't know. I mean, like I said this to Wes before we started, but like I'm rooting for the record. Like I think majority, I posted a poll the other day, or saw someone post a poll, and it's like 60-40 rooting for it. But like you have to root for it at this point. Like what's the point in doing something if you're not going to do it the best? And like we've already come this close to doing it best. So like three more, what is it? We're at 25, four more times, and it's ours. History books, Detroit Pistons. When's the last time you saw history of the Detroit Pistons? It's been at least a decade.
This is not a record that you want. I'm not rooting for it,
No,
but
I
I will
agree.
admit they are approaching this record with some velocity right now. There is a speed and a level of momentum to the losing
Yeah.
that they've been doing. You look at this Jazz game and you look who's on the other team that was healthy. And the best player, probably Colin Sexton. Probably. I mean, it was a bunch of bench guys, a bunch of guys that aren't getting minutes on that team. And you know what? The Pistons got out rebounded. They turned the ball over more than the Jazz, and that's the game. And that's it. And you know what? Actually, let's talk about those turnovers because it's really easy, I think, for a lot of fans to focus on Cade Cunningham and Jaden Ivey combining for 11 turnovers. But to me, that's not the problem. I think the problem is this. You've got Ausar Thompson, three turnovers in 19 minutes. James Wiseman, two turnovers in 15 minutes. Marcus Sasser, two turnovers in 13 minutes. And Isaiah Livers tosses one into boot. Like, you can't have low usage, low minute guys turning the ball over this much. You've got right there, that's
Yeah.
seven turnovers from guys that you absolutely cannot afford having turnovers from. Like, I get that,
No.
okay, Cade, he had six. I'm not going to excuse that, but you expect him to have at least three. You don't expect Ausar Thompson to put up three in 19 minutes. That one's unacceptable. You just can't afford that. And when your margin's this slim, like, I don't know what you could do.
Well, I would say, and not it doesn't excuse Cade's turnovers because the number of turnovers is different than the type of turnovers. And a lot of times he's guilty of these lazy passes where it's like he throws it to the left wing and like it's just this lollipop that gets stolen. It's like a bad football pass that someone just jumps the route and picks off. But the total sum of the turnovers, I mean, his usage rate, I don't have it offhand, but like guys who have the ball that much in this league where, you know, it's so much focused on one guy creating a lot of stuff, the turnovers happen. Like the best players are the ones who have the most turnovers and who have the ball the most. So that's just the way it goes. Now, you're right. The other guys, like the other non-ball handlers, I mean, there's eight turnovers off the bench last night. Like that's unacceptable. But part of the problem there is that you've got, you know, five guys who aren't, you know, you don't have a point guard. There's not, I mean, this is where, like, as much as we all like to, you know, poop on Killian Hayes, like, there was not a point guard out there last night, and there was nobody who could set anything up. And that's why these guys are all taking turns trying to make something happen when they're out there. And frankly, I didn't even think the bench was as damaging as it's been in the past. Like, it certainly wasn't good, but like, I posted a tweet in the start of the third quarter where I was like, the bench is going to come in, they're going to blow this game, and it's going to go from being a lead to the Jazz like taking the quarter. And they weathered the storm quite well. Part of that was because James Wiseman had like four blocks in the third quarter, which was impressive. I'll give him that. But I just think there's just a lack of especially when those other non-Cade guys are out there, I just don't think they know what to do. I don't think – and that's damning on guys like Alec Burks, who've been in the NBA for a decade and can't figure out how to make something work. Like, I think part of what I've noticed over the course of time is like, I've always been a big Monte Morris guy, and I think he would fix a lot of the little things that ail them. He would not fix the team, but they would not be 2-26 bad, as Kate Cunningham said last night. But I think it just – you look at guys like Bogdanovich and like Burks, and I just – they're not – if you want to see a veteran that will go from a bad team to a good team, find one who plays smart as hell on the bad team. And it's not his fault they lose. But like, you watch Alec Burks, like Alec Burks has nights where he is a cause for losses, like his shooting and his decision-making and his bad defense. And Bogdanovich, these nights where he can't make threes, where he just decides he's not going to rebound, he's not going to create, he doesn't do anything. Like, those kind of veterans are not of use to a championship team. You have to be able to make something happen the nights you're not doing the one thing you're good at. And the Pistons don't have those guys. So I think that's a problem for February 13th, whatever the deadline is. But I just, you know, I mean, Bogdanovich played an F minus game last night. Like, he was horrific, like in every sense of the word. And that's unacceptable. You can't have that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it shows up too with the shooting again, right? Because from the 3-point line, they were 29% as a team. And your shooters, mm-hmm. you know, your quote unquote shooters, Bojan Bogdanovich, like you said, awful, 2 of 7. Isaiah Livers, who they keep saying he's a shooter, but he's not shooting like it. 0 of 3. Alec Burks, 0 for 3 as well. Marcus Sasser made 2, but it was 2 of 5. And I got to throw Isaiah Stewart in there because I don't really look at him as a floor spacer, but it sure seems like the team does. He was 1 for 1. He only shot 1 3, and he made it. Like, I don't know how you can expect to compete in even games against this Jazz team that were missing almost everyone of note from that roster due to injury. Yeah. I don't know how you can expect to compete with those teams if you don't rebound, if you turn the ball over, and you can't shoot. Like, you can't even accidentally win a game because this team has no shooters and no one's going to get hot. I'm speechless. I got nothing.
I don't. And I think it's reflected in every Monty Williams press conference at this point, because he doesn't know what to say to anybody anymore, which I understand. And I think, like, if we're assigning blame, like, he deserves a lot of blame, because they've reached a point in this where I think if they played that game, that exact game, in the 8th consecutive loss instead of the 25th consecutive loss, I think they might have been able to finish the game. But I think they've reached this point where they'll never admit it, but there's this creeping dread of it's coming again. It's almost like you can't escape your shadow. That's where they've gotten to this point, where like, they do crumble when it gets, you know, tough and when adversity hits. But I think that's just a byproduct of a bunch of guys who, you know, haven't been put in like mentally difficult situations in the NBA. And here they are finally getting it, but it's not the good kind, you know? So like, Burks did carry the offense a lot last season, but he's just a guy that I'm so out on. And I was so in on him when they first got him. I thought that was a great acquisition, because I was like, finally somebody else who can play next to Cade. But, and somebody like told me it wasn't true, but before the season, like last year, if you watched him play defense, like his give a S level was not high. Like, he did not give effort on that end. He would shoot the ball and play hard on offense. He does not try on defense, and it's gotten worse this year. And I don't know how – I don't think they have another option. That's why he plays. Like, he has to play. They're obviously telling Monty to keep playing him so that he can get hot and they can potentially move him, because he has not earned any of this playing time at all, like, point blank. Like, if it's a meritocracy, it does not apply to Alec Burks at all in general.
Yeah, and I think that's all made worse too by the that idea that a guy can play up his value, or even honestly to some extent play down his value, is such a fallacy. Like, go spin it back to Langston Galloway. I've talked about this before, but spin it back to Langston Galloway shooting almost 60%, it felt like, from three leading up to the trade deadline. What was the best offer they got? A couple of seconds. They passed and kept them. Like, yeah, guys, once you hit a level in the NBA, like Alec Burks has, like Bojan Bogdanovic has, you're known commodities. You know, Alec Burks, if someone's going to look at him and go, oh, he's just going through a cold spell, we'll put him in a better situation, he'll be fine. Like, playing him more doesn't fix it, and it's right now actively hurting the team. They need to turn away. And that's all I'm saying with it. So the last thing I want to hit on here before we get to some questions, which we've gotten a lot of them submitted, so thank you guys, appreciate all of that. Let's talk about Cade Cunningham, because, you know, we brought up the turnovers, we brought up the shooting. He had six. I'm not quite sure that's a coincidence that the six turnovers pops back up on the first game in a while we've seen the two bigs. So let's bring up the last three games from Cade Cunningham, and I want to read off the stats to you. 25, six assists, one rebound, 59% from the floor. 43, seven assists, five rebounds, 67% from the floor. And then against the Jazz, 28 points, 10 assists, 6 rebounds, 46% again on the floor. And he's getting to the free throw line. And the Jazz game's the only game where the turnover problem popped back up. I mean, it is hard not to feel for him, especially after that press conference he gave, where he's clearly playing well. He's just got nothing to help him.
Yeah. I mean, it's the only people who don't see it are Troy Weaver, Arn Tellem, and Ed Stefanski, it seems. The brain, the three-headed monster that apparently is just making this, is just trying to force this square peg into this round hole over and over and over again. But no, I agree. I think it doesn't help that he doesn't have, like, even if there was a better option to go out there, I don't really care who starts at center without Dern around. Like, if it's Stewart, cool. If it's Bagley, cool. Like, they're not going to play defense either way. And, like, Stu plays defense, but his defense does not, like, raise the floor of everybody else. So, like, I just don't think it just blows my mind from a team-building perspective that they looked at this and they said, this will work. Like, that's the most, like, pointed thing you can say, is that this wasn't the plan. Like, that's the part that stings the most, is that these three idiots thought this was going to be the thing. Like, this is it. We got it. We figured it out. I mean, it's just like a black eye to their, I mean, I don't, I, this is one of those things where, like, Weaver's going to go back after, whenever they let go of him, which, whether it's in February or if it's in the summer, like, he ain't coming back next year. I would be shocked. I don't have any intel on that. I just can't imagine that they would have a historically bad season again and he would be brought back. He'll get a job with Oklahoma City again because he's buddies with Sam Presti. But, like, this is the kind of thing that, like, puts a red scarlet letter on you forever and ever. Like, every player, every coach, every executive, all of their sons who are working in the front office, like, everyone's going to have whatever this season ends up being, barring some sort of, you know, rebound to make it 15 and 67 instead of 9 and 70 or whatever, the 9 and 72, whatever it would be. So, I don't know. I just think that the thought that this was going to work, because even this was the first year of the Weaver era where I, like, kind of went into it and I said, this is, I can't fake it and tell you this is going to work. Like, I can't. There's no, they've given us no reason to do that. And there are some people who will, through a smile and whatever else, will tell you that this is all the plan and this is going to work and this is how it goes. But, like, I think we're all on the same page now, deep down, whether you want to say it outwardly or not, but we all know that it's not working. I mean, even, I don't know. I've run out of ways to describe how bad it is. And I don't run out of ways to say things very often.
Yeah. I was just going to say, to back you up, Cade Cunningham, I pulled the last 15 games, his averages, but I want to focus on these three things. Okay, well, four, because I'll also give the percentages that he's been slashing. Now, granted, they are 0 of 15. They're 0 of 15 when this guy is averaging only 3 turnovers a night, 5 free throw attempts, 1.6 stocks. So steals and blocks combined, 45% from the floor, 34% from three, 87% from the line. Like, those are the little things being done successfully by your head of the snake, top level guy, and you are still 0 of 15. That's roster construction. There's no other way to spin that.
I think people have nationally have started to shovel dirt on Cade Cunningham's grave a little bit early. I think that there's a lot of contextual things that are lost when you criticize Cade Cunningham and whether he was a bust or the wrong pick. Like, if you put Scotty Barnes, and I like Scotty Barnes as a player, I thought he'd be rookie of the year when he got it. Like, I was very high on him in the draft. But if you took a guy like that who has skills but is limited and was better because he was playing with multiple all-star caliber players in Toronto, whether their winning record or losing record reflects that. Like, guys like Siakam and Ananobi and Van Vliet, they're all like all-star caliber dudes. And if you took that dude and you threw him on this team, I'm not convinced he would even – I mean, it would be even worse. Like, you can't just expect guys who aren't, like, as skilled and as able as Cade to survive this in that way. Like, like the Bill Simmons thing where it was like, F it, just trade them 5 first-round picks and they can start over again. Like, very typical, like, you know, senile Simmons there. But, like, that's not the only thing. Like, I've seen other people saying that, like, he's probably the 8th best player from the draft. And, like, people have mentioned Jalen Green. And, again, I'm like, I'm not trying to throw shade at Jalen Green, but, like, Jalen Green, again, kind of the same thing that happened with Scotty. Like, they finally got him some good players to play with. They have never went out and gotten anybody unless it was a friend of Troy Weaver, and that's Jeremy Grant. That's the only time he's ever been able to bring in a – like a talent that would start for 60% of the NBA teams, 70, 80%. It's because he knew him. That's the only, like, that's like having one pickup line. And if it doesn't work, then you're kind of screwed, right? You're not going to pick up the girl. So I don't see, like, how you can compare the situation to anything else, because it truly kind of is unprecedented in that way, because there really hasn't been a rebuild that has gone this poorly in this construction of, like, anti-tanking, like, you can't just be bad enough to get the first pick all the time. Like, this is different than the process. This isn't like how those teams were able to do it. Like, the Pistons have seen, and this is probably a wake-up call for a lot of people too, is that, like, Pistons fans were like, tank, tank, tank for years and years. And, like, with these new rules, we got our one guy, and then, you know, what, we shot 50% on the other 6 picks they made? Like, you can't just – tanking does not guarantee you success. Like, unless your player pops off as a star within 3 years, like, you are no better off before than you were after. That's just the way it is.
Totally agree. And it is the rare young player that can elevate above poor roster context. Those are your LeBron Jameses, your, you know, eventually, like, Kobe Bryant's. Like, it's a rarity. It's rare. So let's actually kind of stay on this track here with this first question from a fella in the DBB chat. He asks, do you think Cade Cunningham is really the guy? If so, who on this team has the best chance to be Robin? Who off the team could have the best chance as well? You first.
Well, I would say Batman's hard to say, because I think if you look at the entirety of the NBA, there are Batman, like, A-plus, like, alpha character dudes. Like, there's, what, maybe 10 of them total? Like, and I'm, like, looking at guys like LeBron and Giannis and the types that you know you can just get and you're going to be better. I don't know if he's that top 10 guy, like, at this point. Like, and that's not a shot at him. Like, I just don't know. Like, I don't know if the physical limitations he has will keep him from being that. I don't know if his lack of being a high level shooter will, you know, do that. Like, he does everything well, but, like, is he closer to being Jaylen Brown than Jason Tatum? Like, that's possible. And, you know, Jaylen Brown gets a lot of crap, but, like, he's a pretty darn good player. So, like, I go back and forth on that watching him play, because he needs help. And I don't know, when I say he needs help, I don't know if he needs somebody else. Because, like, Jaden Ivey, like, is kind of complimentary in ways that it should help him, even if he's not used correctly. But, like, maybe he just needs, like, to be the second guy with another star. And that's what, unfortunately, like finding that guy, like you said, who is that off this team? I don't know, because those guys don't just come available, you know? Like, I think they would need to find another wing player, a star wing player, who could come in and help and raise that ceiling. But teams don't give those guys up. And that's why, like, until Jaylen Brown signed his, like, ridiculous deal with Boston, that was the name that people often would throw out. Is, hey, maybe the Tatum-Brown thing doesn't work for them. It obviously has. And we can get him. And I don't – that's the type of player you need, I think. But I just I don't know. It's hard to say who it's going to be. I mean, I would love to say it's Cooper Flagg, but I don't know if any of us can handle this year and next year of that. But if they make changes, I'm not convinced that it won't be a possibility next year. And that would be the kind of player that I think you get a big man who can do a bunch of stuff and plays defense. Like, that's the other part of it. Is if you get a defensive big man who can score from all three levels, like, yeah, that would make Cade Cunningham a hell of a lot better, especially when you pair him with Ivy and Asar, for example. And then you can figure out how Dern fits with Flag. Like, big guys don't do much for me at this point. I like Jalen Dern, but he's not someone who, like, I'm, you know, hinging my rebuild on at this point. Like, he's a good player, but he hasn't shown me enough durability or ability to do things for a sustained period to, like, buy in as a Robin type player for Cade.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I mean, the real question, I guess, behind if Cade Cunningham is really quote unquote the guy is the guy for what? You know, like, I think you could take Cade Cunningham right now as is, even as he's obviously still improving, still growing as a player. I think right now, if you built a fairly competent and talented roster around him as a centerpiece, you could probably get a playoff team. Like, I'm fairly confident in that. Could you get a team, you know, in 5 years that could win or compete for a championship? I don't know. Jury's very much still out. I mean, it's possible, but you bring up the physical limitations. The efficiency is obviously a problem. The turnovers until recently have been a big problem. There's a lot kind of going against him. Doesn't mean he can't figure it out. And it also doesn't mean he was the wrong pick at number one a couple of years ago, right? So what I'll say is this. I think that the best shot to be Robin is probably off the team, because I think to get anywhere, whether it's this deadline or in the offseason, you're going to need to part with some of these young guys that are not named Cade Cunningham just in order to build a halfway competent roster, hopefully start competing for the playoffs and see what you can do from there, right? Like, at this point, we don't know how far it could go. And it's so bad, it's so far gone, that it's almost impossible to even make a guess.
Well, the other thing, too, is if you look at, like, take Monty Williams' time in Phoenix, for example. Like, he goes there in, I think it was 2019-20. That was that first year with the COVID bubble. And, like, yeah, they ended up playing a lot better for once after being just horrendous for the first few years. And, like, people will say, like, you know, he got Devin Booker, but Devin Booker was already like a stud then. Like, Devin Booker was scoring, like, was having like 60 point, literally like 60 point games once or twice before that. So, like, you do that.
I believe the 70 point night predates Monty as well.
70 point. Yeah, it does. Right. So you have a guy who's like, in that version of Devin Booker is not as good as the version now, but that version then was probably better than the version of Cade Cunningham we have right now. Then you factor in that they like just acquired Chris Paul, which, you know, what we say about Chris Paul today is different than what it was 4 or 5 years ago, because like when they were at their best and they were going to the finals, like it was still Chris Paul was the one who was the 1A, you know, to the point of one of the commenters, like 1A, 1B, like Chris Paul was still the guy. So I just look at it like, you know, does it feel weird to say that a bad team should go out and acquire like an old guy like Chris Paul? Like, yes, it does. But sometimes that's what it requires for you to be able to like make that jump. And like, even if we look at, you know, Phoenix as they've gone, like, you know, if Devin Booker was truly a 1A like alpha superstar, why do you go out and get Bradley Beal? Why do you go out and get Kevin Durant? Like, you should be like there's different ways of constructing stuff. And if you have like a Giannis, like how the Bucks have done it, and they went out and got Damian Lillard, who was a alpha for a team, like you said, Wes, that like kind of tops out as being good playoff team, but nowhere near like title contenders. So like, there's different scales for what that means, but I just think that, like, you know, it's hard to think about that type of perspective with this team where it's at now, because we shouldn't be thinking about it that way. Like, you shouldn't cash out on somebody now because it hasn't worked for 2 years and 30 terrible games. Like, that's not smart. That's not smart business. Like, you wouldn't, if you sold stocks, you wouldn't sell a stock when it just started to get bad. You would, after paying a ton to get it, like, you don't just cash out and start over. So, I don't know. I think it's just like, maybe he is a 1B, and that's fine, or a Robin. Like, you still have to find a Batman either way, even if he's not it. Like, you still have to find that guy. And even if Cade was that, it shouldn't stop you from looking for it. Like, the Thunder kept going when they had Kevin Durant, and they found 3 Batmans. It didn't work out because of other things, but, like, never stop looking for those guys. Like, it shouldn't be a, like, precursor to then be like, okay, let's just find some good role players and call it good. That's not how it works.
Yeah, I totally agree. So on that line, let's actually talk about some Chris Paul. We had KKRZ in the DBB comments. He proposes a trade. So the Warriors would get Bojan Bogdanović and Isaiah Stewart, and the Pistons would get Chris Paul, Moses Moody, and 2 first-round picks. So one, just in general, what would you think about the idea of actually going and getting a Chris Paul and adding that to this team? And then 2, what do you think about that trade specifically?
I did this, not this version of it, but I did trade Chris Paul to the Pistons the other day just to see how it would work. I think I traded Alec Burks and something else. It was like Bojan and Alec Burks, something like that. So I didn't give him beef stew. I don't think the version of Chris Paul that you would bring here today is the difference maker that Phoenix brought in when we were just talking. So I think, and I also don't think you'd get 2 first round pick swaps for those 2. Like, that's not going to happen, because it's just like, I don't know how much, that trade really helps the Warriors. Especially because, like, they're still very short on their bench in terms of guards. Like, Chris Paul is kind of filling the Jordan Poole, like, ball handler role, even if he did it completely differently. So now you're, like, taking away all of their guard depth, essentially. And they have some wings that can't really dribble but can shoot, even though Wiggins can't shoot right now. I just don't think that that would really fix anything for either side.
Yeah, well, I'm with you that I don't think the Warriors would accept this deal. I think they're sending out way more value than they're getting back. Even though Bojan is probably a decent target for them, if for a buy low, not for anything of much value. Regardless, specifically to the idea of Chris Paul, I mean, I think on concept, any guy that can lift the floor just a little bit, maybe provide some stability, is a good idea. That said, I'm not sure there's a match with what the Pistons would need to give up salary-wise to go get a guy like that, and what the Warriors would be willing to accept for him. So I'm not sure the fit's there between both teams, as much as Monty Williams might love to get Chris Paul back. And then even further, right, Chris Paul's actually kind of a guy that a lot of people have compared Cade Cunningham to in the first place. So if you're really trying to go one for one with what the Suns had those early years, like, you should be looking for Devin Booker or Mikal Bridges. You shouldn't be looking to add Chris Paul. So do you have anything more to add on this one?
No, I don't. Yeah, I think that having a veteran like Chris Paul would help. I don't know if Chris Paul is the right guy. That's I'm with you there.
All right, next question from our guy Mark Faust. He says, is there a sunk cost situation where you toss most of the issues with this roster to a first-time GM, but you like his drafting enough to kind of let Weaver continue on? So it sounds like a question of, would you rather move on with Troy Weaver, letting him have, you know, another offseason and maybe taking the reins off him if you think there might be any reins? Or do you just say it's bad, time to move on now, let the season end? Because presumably if you do fire Weaver, you're not going to make a hire and make some trades at the deadline. You're probably stuck where you're at. So there's me recontextualizing, Mark. Hope I got it right.
No, it's the exact situation that the Tigers were in 2 years ago when they had El Avila, and he had been a mess for years, and they kept him around and let him do the draft, because they did the draft in the middle of the summer, and, like, why would you let a lame duck general manager run your draft? Like, doesn't make any sense. But I saw, I think it was today on Twitter, like Joe Truck was talking about it, but like, you know, you have to like clean house if you fire them. Like if you fire Weaver, you're not fixing the problem. It's just like you're removing part of the tumor, but the cancer still exists. So you have to get rid of Arn and Stefanski too. And so like, I think if you fired them, you are just eating the season. And that's very scary, because then you're like trying to trade a 35, going on 36 boy on in the summertime, which you're not going to get anything for. I don't think you can keep him though. I think here's the way I think about it is, if what's the trade deadline in February, if they make a trade between now and February, he's not going anywhere. That's the reality. I can't put it past Gores to let him make trades and then also fire him because he's just a wild card like that. But if they're like, if they don't make any trades before the deadline, I think they would fire him around the deadline, because that would just be to say like, we don't want you to F this up anymore. Please just send your hands and then we'll pay you to go away. And like, I think that's what's going to end up happening. But if they make a trade, if you see them go out and acquire failed lottery prospect Z, who, you know, the next James Wiseman or Josh Jackson, then we know that like they're re-rolling and they're doing this again. And you're going to let, and the other part too is like, Weaver drafted, I mean, Cade was pretty obvious at the time. I wish he would have, in hindsight, I wish there a lot of things would have gone differently, even though I love Cade, but like Cade was not like a expert scouting decision. Killian Hayes was a horrific scouting decision. Isaiah Stewart was a fine player, but not the right pick probably. And Sadiq Bey is like just a dude. Like he pretty much like Stu, just a dude. And then everything else, like Asar's good, but like it's too early to tell. And then what, Jaden Ivey, like, I don't know. I mean, we all were like, a lot of people, not all of us, but a lot of people were crying about the possibility of Keegan Murray. Keegan Murray just hit 12 three-pointers in three quarters like 4 days ago. The Pistons haven't hit 12 three-pointers in multiple games this year. So like, I don't give him much credit for anything. He's made a few trades where he's very good at like efficiently buying low on players sometimes. Like the Monte Morris trade, it was basically free. Boyan, it was very much just a free trade. Getting the pick that got him Durin was a good trade. But overall, I there's nothing I would point to and be like, this guy's good. Like, he's good at getting you, like, moving the numbers around and, like, shifting the margins. But, like, the sum of this whole thing hasn't risen with him here. He hasn't made a trade that, like, changed the trajectory of the franchise in any capacity.
Yeah. So I was going to bring up that first draft and kind of try and paint this as a no-win scenario, because I really do think that it is. So on one hand, you could fire him now, right? And you're going to go through the trade deadline with almost no move made, maybe something on the margins, but nothing significant enough to actually start building into next season, right? So you're kind of just telling everyone to get aboard this train and you're just going to ride it out. No exits, you're stuck. And then the upside of that is you actually do have some time. If you hire a guy early enough in the offseason to try and fill out the scouting staff, actually get a pretty good feel for the draft class, all that stuff. Hopefully the draft goes better. On the other end, you could try and let Weaver figure out this deadline. Maybe he does something good enough where the team's not historically awful and, you know, you're saved for this season. But if you still go through and say, you know what, not good enough, we're going to move on, get a new guy, then go back and look at Weaver's first draft as kind of the red warning card to stop, because he did not have enough time to build up his staff. He did not have full information on that. And you could look back, a lot of GMs, their first draft classes, not very strong. It's because you don't have the full support staff around you yet to have a great idea or picture of what, you know, all these picks are going to be. So you look and like, you know, Killian is probably a rotation level guy. Stewart's a rotation level guy. Sadiq's a rotation level guy. Like, none of those are horrible, horrible misses. But compared to what potentially they could have gotten and maybe would have known to get if they had had more information and more time, they look pretty bad. So I don't know what the best path forward here is. I think you kind of lose no matter what. It's just They're in a bad spot.
Yeah.
They're in a bad spot.
I mean, they're not, I mean, Killian has gotten past this, but like, none of them are Sekou, but like, which is just like a horrific, like just bad player. But like, I just think in general, I just look at it and it's like, you're right. That was probably the most challenging scouting year of,
right,
you know, of all time. And going into that 2020 draft, like people did think that like, oh, this is a really bad draft class too. Like it's not good, you know, good luck finding guys. And it's proven to be like, you know, one of the better draft classes we've seen. And I think, you know, I mean, James Wiseman, for example, I mean, he played, what, 11 games in college. LaMelo Ball was playing in Australia. Patrick Williams had a really good season for Florida State. He really hasn't turned into anything. That was apparently Troy's favorite player. Okoro is just a guy. Okungwa is just a guy. Killian is like, I mean, I think he's a rotation player on some teams, but I don't think if you gave him to the Suns, he would be, like, playing playoff minutes for them. Like, he's not that. Yeah,
he's a fifth guard.
Yeah, so, like, but it, there is the story that the Pistons passed on Tyrese Haliburton because they weren't convinced he could shoot. And then they took a guy who had only been able to shoot ever for like a 10-game stretch in the German mega league or whatever it was. So like there's a lot of things wrong. The problem I run into now though is also if you keep him around, this year's draft is a crapshoot. Like if you look at a mock draft on any given week, there's a different dude at the top. Like there are some guys like Alexander Sarr is sometimes at the top. Like he's a big guy from Australia. That would probably be the pick, and that scares the shit out of me too. Because again, is he going to pick another center? And we're going to have to just keep drafting guys without fit. There's Ron Holland who's playing in the G League, and he's like athletic wing, but he's kind of like a little bit of an Andrew Wiggins enigma because like the physical skills don't necessarily translate to the stats that you'd want. And then there's guys like Matas Bezelis, who's just kind of like a toolbox, hasn't put it together. There's a lot of guys, but like, it doesn't sound like there's a game changer, you know, any sort of guy who's like obvious. So you're going to have this happen. And like, knowing this draft is a mess, they're going to get the first pick. Like, I'm confident that they're going to get the first pick in a draft that doesn't have a Wemby, it doesn't have like an Anthony Edwards, and it's going to be like, all right, good luck not finding the next Andre Bargnani. Like, that's the situation that we're in. That's what makes this worse, is it would be so much less depressing if this was happening in a year where it's like, hey, there's four really good guys. But it's not. Like, it's a bunch of guys who are the same thing they already have, and it's not – none of them are going to make them better next year. I'm pretty convinced of that.
No, I agree. And you don't really want to be relying on a rookie to save you anyway at this point when you already have – five guys you're trying to prioritize. Anyway, let's move on. Next question from Johnny Boy number one from the DBB chat. We talked a little about Killian Hayes. So what's a realistic return in a trade for Killian Hayes? What do you think?
Cap space in the summer when he leaves. I don't think you can trade him. I mean, you would trade him for one of those second round picks that's protected through the top 55 or something like that. Like what do you... Flip the question. What's a realistic offer for Killian Hayes? If you're a team that like, hey, we really could use a third point guard. Like, what are you going to give up for a third point guard? Like, Killian Hayes isn't going to change your trajectory or anything like that. So like, maybe you can get another like project player for him. You know, like that's possible. Maybe that's the way that he can like re-roll is go out and trade Killian Hayes for some other underperforming former lottery pick from like 2 years ago. I don't know. I don't think there's any value. He's got the most value to the Pistons because they don't have that many ball handlers. And I don't think that if Monte Morris comes back, which I don't think he will at this point, but if he comes back, like, I don't see where Killian Hayes fits. Like, he's not better than Monte Morris. And, like, he doesn't really, I don't know. I just don't know what someone would want to give up. Not necessarily what you would be willing to accept as a return. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that there is a return for Killian Hayes in a trade. Like you said, it's going to be the cap space when, gosh, I hope they don't pick up the qualifying offer, which you never know. He seems to be Monty Williams' baby blanket, and I wish that someone would just rip that away from him right now. Anyway, yeah, I don't think there's a return at all. I don't think anyone's looking for him.
Here's a question. Would you trade Killian Hayes to the Hawks for AJ Griffin? AJ Griffin had a nice rookie year. He's been a non-factor out of the rotation this year. Like, that's the kind of like return that I think you would have to kind of prepare yourself for, is that like, hey, if a team, not that Atlanta needs him, but I'm just speaking from like a player for player thing, but like, that's the level of players like AJ Griffin, like a guy who had a lot of warts coming out and hasn't really performed well, but like, or like the Spurs are like, hey, we need a point guard. This Jeremy Sochan playing point guard thing is not working. We'll give you Malachi Branham for him. And it's like, sure, even though I know Malachi Branham starts for them and he's probably better. But like, that's the kind of return you're looking for, where it's not going to be like some game changer of any type. It's just like, hey, we have another similarly talented player at the three now instead of the one.
So you stole the two teams I was about to name, which is hilarious. The Hawks, because they have a utterly horrific cap situation. So the idea that they might just like dump something for a contract that ends is not out of the question. Yeah. I mean, that might be like money for a washing machine that you trade there, but you know, maybe you get off them. And then the Spurs, because they do seem to have this infatuation with guards that can't shoot. I mean, they're playing Sochan at the point guard. They play Trey Jones a lot of minutes. Like, that's just the Popovich special right there. Foreign guard right now that can't shoot the three and really doesn't do much else. Like, there you go, right up his alley. But realistically, I don't see it happening. I think he's going to be on the team, and hopefully they don't pick up the qualifying offer and he's somewhere else next year.
Yeah, I don't see how he has I don't see how he has a future here. I think if they changed leadership in the front office, that would basically be the end of it. Like, I can't see somebody else coming in, because it seems like people get all worked up when like national reporters will say like who was it? Tim Bontemps was like, punt Killian Hayes to the moon. Those guys don't just speak poorly of players because it's their opinion. Oftentimes their opinion is rooted in what they hear from other teams. So it's like, hey, I'm saying this guy sucks because everyone tells me he sucks. Like, that's kind of where it comes from. It's not just like us where we're just throwing it out there because we watch him and we think he sucks. Like, there's usually some sort of thing. Like, I don't think that there's like teams that are fawning over that guy around the league. You know, like, he's just a player that I wouldn't be surprised, honestly, too, if it like he runs out his contract this year and like he's good enough to go be someone's third point guard. Like, he's on the Frank Ntilikina, another French guard, trajectory right now. So, like, if he gets to the summer and it's like, hey, I can go be Dallas's third point guard and play when they need me, or I could go back home and I could make a ton of money and be really good in France, like, I would not surprise me if he did that. Like, that's with any European player, you can't put that past it, because, like, that's always a possibility. And, like, the marketability of Killian Hayes in France is massive, I'm sure, compared to how it is here. So, like, a lot of different layers. But I think, you know, like last year, people would say like, oh, I can't see Hami Diallo doing anything on an NBA team. And I was like, no way. He's got stuff. He does fun things. Like, he can be on an NBA team. Nope, he's playing for the Capital City Go-Go. So, like, you know, is Killian Hayes better than Hami was last year? I think they're probably comparable impact players for what they do. So, like, maybe that's just where he's looking. I don't know. It's hard to say. You can't really, you know, judge what 29 other teams think about a guy.
Yeah, the last thing I'll say with Killian, and to give him a little bit of credit, is that coming into the season, I was not convinced he had proven that he was a legitimate NBA player. And I think now he's been consistent enough through the first few, you know, this first kind of quarter of the season, that I could say he's probably going to get a minimum contract somewhere, which is an improvement from where I thought he was before. So, moving on to the next one. This is from our guy, YouTube user. Always appreciate you, man. He says, do you think that Asar Thompson should spend some time in the G League to learn how to dribble? I know we're short on the wings, but Kevin Knox could eat up some of those minutes. So what do you think about Asar Thompson getting a G League stint?
No. I'm not sure if you've heard or if YouTube user knows this, but Amen Thompson is currently in the G League, because there's not enough minutes to play him in Houston. And you tell me if this is helping him. Amen Thompson's in the G League averaging 23 points, 11 rebounds, and 8 assists. Like, to me, that says that guy's way too good for the G League. And as someone who, like, back in the day in a previous life, I covered, like, the G League. So I've seen I've seen it up close quite a bit, and I can't say that style of basketball would help a player improve, really. I don't, unless that guy just isn't getting reps. I think it's good for like playing basketball. Just if you haven't played a lot of basketball, it's good to get on there. But from a skills perspective, they don't play defense. Like the G League is all points all day, all the time. So like he probably would tear it up down there because I don't think he would need to have any sort of advanced dribbling. And I also don't know that like what he's playing on now is not that far away from that like level of stakes. So like, why not just play him and let him dribble here? Like he's not good at it. That's obvious. Like when we watch him dribble, it looks like somebody in the dribbling, like warm-up drill practice does not get to dribble the ball very often. But like, I say just let him do it in the NBA. Like I'd rather see him develop at this level against this competition than him go down there. And I don't think he's short on confidence right now, maybe on his jumper, but like overall he still goes out there and plays hard most nights. Except a couple nights ago, actually, he was kind of like, they brought him in for a defensive possession at the end of the game against the Hawks, and the way he was defending Trae Young, it looked like he did not feel comfortable being on the floor at that point. So I don't know, but I don't think that would help him though. I think you've got the best development you possibly can get with the Pistons, just stick to that.
Well, to the credit of YouTube, like I get where you're coming from on this because, you know, I agree. I think that the effort for the most part has been there, but his stocks are down since he was moved to the bench. His rebounds are down since he's moved to the bench, like even just on a per minute basis. So he's not playing as well as he was early in the season. I think it's possible he's kind of hitting a rookie wall. I mean, I don't know how many games OTE really played, and definitely don't know how many games OTE did like back to backs on, right? So a guy of his level of athlete and, you know, hustle level out there, I do think he's probably hitting a wall. So I get the idea of wanting to, okay, send him down, get him some confidence, bring him back up. But that being said, like you mentioned, the G League, not known for perimeter defense. So on the one hand, you're not pressuring him enough to really sharpen up that ball handling that he needs to work on. And then the other aspect that of his game that he really needs to improve is finishing around the rim. And if you're a big man in the G League who can protect the rim, you're called up immediately. You are not in the G League anymore. It is over. No more minutes. You're with an NBA team. So the G League just doesn't have guys that can help him in either category. You know, no iron sharpening iron there. He'll go down, dominate like his brother, get pulled back up, and it will be in the same boat. So I'm with you. I think the best thing they can do for him is to keep giving him, you know, his 20 minutes a night. Hopefully he can work through it. Maybe you give him a break. You know, earlier in the year, Monty Williams did give Sasser like a week break, and he did seem to come back from that a little rejuvenated. I could see something like that being valuable for Asar Thompson, but not the G League. I think I'd pass on that one.
No, I don't think playing more minutes with Jared Rodin and Stanley Amudi is going to help him.
Yeah, agreed. So, all right, let's hit on a couple more before we wrap it up. This one is from Far North in the DBB comments section. So the Knicks obviously just lost Mitchell Robinson from the year, I believe, with an ankle injury. So do you think they might want one of the many centers on this roster? And if so, what might they possibly be willing to give up for it? So obviously we're talking potentially Jalen Turin, if you want to go that far, but James Wiseman and Marvin Bagley.
Oh, boy. I mean, I haven't even thought about trading Jalen Duren. I mean, I bet you could trade Jalen Duren for R.J. Barrett. That might be something they'd, like, look at. But I don't know. R.J. Barrett makes a lot of money, and he's not been shooting the ball great this year. But that's, like, off the hip. That's a trade I would consider making, probably just from a fit perspective. You can always find another center. But I like Duren. Stewart doesn't make a lot of sense there. I don't think that a Stewart Randall front court is really something that they have a very, very, very specific type of center they have. Like Mitch Robinson and Jericho Sims are these dudes who are just raw, jump out of the gym, athletic big dudes. And that would be a contrast from Stewart. And I don't think Stewart plays the game dissimilarly to Isaiah Hartenstein, who's their I think doing a fine job as like a replacement. Isaiah Hart's in their center right now, but like that wouldn't work. I mean, if they wanted Wiseman, like I would do that. I would talk to them about James Wiseman if they were interested, but I don't think Weaver would. I don't know why he would. That's like his, that player has kind of become the front office's version of like the like golden egg. Like, no, if we trade him, then we admit defeat on that other trade. We can't do that. Like, and he's gotten better, so I'm sure they're also taking pride in that. But like, I don't see them moving him ever. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they're still around, the front office stays, like Wiseman comes back as the third center. Like, that makes sense to me. But Bagley's one, actually, now that I think about it, Bagley could make sense there just from like an offensive boost perspective, because he's better than Jericho Sims and he's just as athletic. But I think they want defense at that spot. I think the only fit defensively is Stewart, and I just don't like how he fits physically in that front court.
I agree. Like, we got to remember, this is Tom Thibodeau, right? He is going to have an aneurysm if he has to play Marvin Bagley or James Wiseman, any kind of minutes out there. Tom Thibodeau only cares about defense. And if you're a big man that can't defend or rebound, which those two don't do very well, I cannot under any circumstances envision him being okay and signing off on a trade that brings them in. So I do, you know, Isaiah Stewart is probably the one guy that they might be interested in. It sounds like a few teams are fairly interested in Isaiah Stewart. And, you know, he does seem like a Tom Thibodeau guy, a little more gritty, good defender, all that stuff. But I just, you know, what do they have that would be worth giving, sending out Isaiah Stewart? I don't know. So I don't really think there's a fit there on this one.
Maybe Isaiah Stewart. Maybe Stewart can go to New York and be their 2023 version of Anthony Mason, because it's just like little gritty forward center dude who plays hard but doesn't do anything particularly well. Like, he fits from like we talk about, like, this is a Pistons player, and that has kind of lost cachet over the years because we haven't seen a Pistons player in like 20 years. But like, if you tell me there's like a Nick, like this guy is a New York Nick, like Isaiah Stewart fits that like Pat Riley 90s Knicks like mold for sure.
Oh yeah, definitely he does. And I do think, you know, just on a general level, Isaiah Stewart's a guy that if you put him in a proper role with a much better team around him, I do think he would excel.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Yeah,
I think that applies to like a lot of. I mean, it's similar to like Sadiq. At one point this season, Sadiq Bey's like offensive rating was like top five in the NBA, and people are like, "Look what you traded away." And it's like, no, look who he plays with now. Like, that's all it is. He isn't just taking shots whenever he wants to anymore. He's got to wait and get the good ones, and that's what it takes. I mean, that's what role player. That's like the scalability of a role player. Like, we haven't had a star in a long, long time outside of like Blake Griffin for a year and a half. But like, you know, the idea of like this guy's bad in this spot but good in this spot, like, people forget that now because we only look at it like in the current situation. But like, the same thing applies to Cade, applies to Isaiah Stewart, and applies to everybody else. Like, if you put good things around them, chances are they're going to be better. Like, that's just the way it goes.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, last one. Let's end on maybe a little bit of a positive, maybe not, depending on how we answer this. But this is for Rames in the DBB comments section asking, has Cade's play over the past month provided any insurance that there is a path forward for this rebuild? And really quick, just for your context, I'll give you the past 15 games for Cade Cunningham. 23 points per game, 7 assists, 4 rebounds, 3.3 turnovers, 5 free throw attempts, 1.6 stocks, and 45, 34, 87 is his slash.
It makes it's better than the alternative. I certainly feel that. Like, it's not the, I don't know, Cade does not worry me. He's my least worried part of all of this. Like, there's not a part of me that's concerned that he's not good enough to be one of the best players in the next good Pistons team, like, point blank. He doesn't worry me that he's too good for us to not be able to be bad enough to get more guys. Like, I think that's the perfect situation from that perspective solely. Like, I don't have any assurance that the rest of it's working. Like, I don't have any assurances that Jalen Duren can stay healthy, that Monty Williams is ever going to figure out how to use Jaden Ivey, the front office is what they're doing. Like, all those parts are out of Cade's control. So, like, as long as we have him around, I think it's fine. And I've seen people say he's going to be the first rookie, like, star to ever turn down that max extension. And, like, it's kind of scary that you're going to pay that guy. I mean, you have to pay Cade, like, max money 2 years from now, no matter what we see between now and then, if you want to keep him, unless he's just a swell guy and gives you a discount. But, like, I think as long as you have him around, at least you have something. And I think as long as he continues to improve, he'll never be, like, a dead body on a bad contract like that. Like, he'll be expensive. And if you ever have to move him once he signs that deal, it's not going to be fun. But, like, he's young enough and he's good enough and he's not, like, a POS. So we're like, you're going to be able to move that guy. Like, good chemistry, good vibes, good basketball player. Like, that's all you can ask for. I still feel like he's the only one that, like, I'm confident in, which is pretty pathetic after 4 years, but that's just the reality we live in.
Yeah, he's the only one that I'm confident in too. I mean, we talked about it a little bit earlier where I do honestly believe that if you kind of dropped everything, all of the plans that, you know, whatever failed plans they have, and just say, okay, restart, we're going to try and build everything to help Cade Cunningham out, I do think you'd get a pretty good team out of it. I don't think it'd be a top four seed or anything like that, but I think you would at least rise to the level of somewhere in play into maybe sixth, right? You'd be a playoff team, a solid playoff team, if you tried that right now. So I do think that, and maybe that should give you a little bit of confidence, because he is, like, without a question, he's playing well, right? All the complaints people had early in the season, turnovers, yeah, down, free throws up, 3-point percentage up, efficiency up, like, across the board, he's figuring it out, and it looks really good. It's just there's no one else there around him to actually kind of take it beyond and even go win a game right now. Everything's so worn down. So, you know, is there a little bit of hope? Sure, if they decide that they want to only build around Cade Cunningham and that's all that matters, then great. You know, I think that's the path forward. But I'll also say that it worries me that you look up and down this roster, and I honestly believe that's maybe the only path out of the dungeon that they're in right now. Yeah. I'm not sure there's another direction they could go to conceivably start winning games even 2 years from now, which
no, I mean,
is worrying for other reasons.
Well, you look at it and it's like, say they have this job, this front office is cleaned out, and it's like, hey, I want to bring in one person to run the whole thing, and here's what you have. Like, overall, I mean, you have some talent, you have one blue chip-ish player, and you have a bunch of cap space, and you have no financial burden on you, really, and you're only down, you're down a first-round pick, technically. But at this point, honestly, people used to complain a lot about the Isaiah Stewart first-round pick. Like, we're never going to convey that as a first-round pick at this rate. Like, they're going to be back. I'm going to actually, before I speak out of turn, let me see what the – do you remember what the protections are on that pick, Wes?
18 this year. I believe it's 18 next year. After that, I
then
think it drops to 13.
It turns into it does eventually
– it keeps dropping until about 2027, where I think it could effectively be nothing.
Uh-huh. By 2027, then it becomes a second rounder. And what are we at? So 4 years from now, do we think we'll be picking outside the top 13 within 4 years? Probably. But here's the thing, too, is, I mean,
if I hope
by next year. Well, I think the hit rate on the 14th overall player, I mean, and that would bug me, but it wouldn't bug me that much if they're playing good. So, like, yeah, it's a hindrance. But I think overall, you look at this everything they've got, and it's not a bad spot to be in if you come in with a plan. Now, it's harder to say that when it's like, what has been the plan for 4 years? Because it's two different situations. Like, what it means to Troy Weaver today and what it means to the next guy tomorrow is different, because Troy Weaver's obviously been trying something and failing at it, and it doesn't seem like he has a plan. But if someone else comes in, they're going to be able to execute their plan in theory much faster. So that's a positive. That's about the only thing I can say positive, but a lot of other stuff has to happen for us to get to that point.
All right, let's end on that kind of backhanded positivity we just talked about there. Yeah. Brady, thanks for jumping on, man. Why don't you let all the listeners know where they can find all your work, and we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, you can find me at Detroit Bad Boys. You can find me on Twitter at Brady Fred, like you can see in the bottom corner over here. But yeah, thank you for having me on, Wes. This is great. This is a great little early Christmas present. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. This was a great time. So, guys, we're going to close it out. Special thank you to Sean Corp, the managing editor of Detroit Bad Boys, for supporting the show. Sean's great. This doesn't happen without him. So, shout out to all you guys as well for all the great questions, all the talking points. We'll catch you next week, whether on your commute or live with us on YouTube. We can't wait to talk more Detroit basketball with you.